I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this is a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for Sergei Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances. The late 1930s were difficult times for Sergei Rachmaninoff, with the exception of his rhapsody on a theme of Paganini, premiered right here in Baltimore, by the way, November 7th, 1934, by Leopold Stokowski and the Philadelphia Orchestra. That was a huge success. His latest works were less than successful. The Fourth Piano Concerto and Corelli Variations were not well received, and the Third Symphony fared little better. A discouraged Rachmaninoff gave up composing and resigned himself to being the superb pianist he was. He had been concertizing for a living ever since leaving Russia in December of 1917. The life of endless train trips and time away from family was a heavy price to pay. It didn't help that his health was failing, and he tended toward depression at the best of times. Nevertheless, it was his job to support them, and support them he did. There were other factors that Rachmaninoff could not control that were also worrisome. Ever since leaving Russia, the composer had spent his summers in Europe composing. However, with the outbreak of the war in September of 1939, Rachmaninoff left Europe for good and settled permanently in the United States. Adding to Rachmaninoff's discomfort was that his daughter was living in France, and even worse, she was taking driving lessons. He said, "This worries me no less than the war. I never felt she had any talent for driving." Rachmaninoff himself, by the way, loved driving, loved motorboats, loved anything that moved quickly, it seems. He rented an estate named Orchard Point near Huntington, Long Island, and there, surrounded by some extremely talented neighbors, he set up shop. "You're just dying to know who these people were, aren't you? Well, then allow me to name drop. Vladimir and Wanda Horowitz, the great choreographer Michel Fokine, Rachmaninoff's former secretary Yevgeny Somov, and Steinway Piano Company representative Alexander Greiner." Perhaps it was the fact that the war had finally begun and there was no more worry and anticipation. Perhaps it was his new home had a special room where he could compose undisturbed and unheard. Whatever the reason, two things happened. One, Rachmaninoff began practicing nonstop for his upcoming winter tour of 1940. Two, he returned to composition. It was always Rachmaninoff's desire to compose a ballet. For whatever reason, the project never materialized. He always wanted to work with Michel Fokine from the Ballet Russe, and finally, in 1939, Fokine adapted the rhapsody on a theme of Paganini into a ballet. Entitled Paganini, it was a huge success at Covent Garden. Encouraged by this success, he asked Fokine if he was interested in another project. Rachmaninoff's new work was first entitled Fantastic Dances, but eventually became Symphonic Dances. Rachmaninoff once said in an interview he would have been happy just calling them dances, but then he was worried that it would be confused with popular jazz music, so symphonic dances it was. He envisioned a three-movement work and originally wanted to call the pieces Noon, Twilight, and Midnight. There's no question that the composer would have collaborated with Fokine to stage the work. Sadly, the great choreographer passed in August of 1942, only to be followed by Rachmaninoff in March of the following year. On August 21, 1940, Rachmaninoff wrote the following to Eugene Normandy, the relatively new music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. "Last week I finished a new symphonic piece which I naturally want to give first to you and your orchestra. It's called Fantastic Dances. I shall now begin the orchestration. Unfortunately, my concert tour begins on August 14th. I have a great deal of practice to do, and I don't know whether I shall be able to finish the orchestration before November. I should be very glad if upon your return you would drop over to our place. I should like to play the piece for you." Rachmaninoff's choice of Philadelphia was simple. It was an orchestra he knew well and one he liked. They had premiered a number of his works, and it was the only orchestra he ever recorded with a soloist. Rachmaninoff even had ambitions to conduct the orchestra, but sadly was passed over for Leopold Stokowski. Ormandy took over from him. Rachmaninoff failed to finish orchestrating the piece before his concert tour started, and so it was completed on the road. Whenever he would arrive at a new city, there would be pages of music awaiting his approval. Rehearsals went smoothly. When Ormandy complained that the bowings were complicated, Rachmaninoff said, "Oh, Fritz helped me with those," meaning the eminent violinist Fritz Kreisler. There was no more complaining. Rachmaninoff also sought out assistance in writing for saxophone from the great arranger and composer Robert Russell Bennett. Whatever he told Rachmaninoff, it must have been the goods. The saxophone solo in the first movement is one of the most beautiful moments in the piece. More on that later. The first performance on January 3, 1941 in Philadelphia was practically a love fest. Rachmaninoff told the orchestra, "Years ago, I composed for the great Shaliapin. Now he is dead, and so I compose for a new kind of artist, the Philadelphia Orchestra." High praise indeed. A few days later, the work was performed in New York and was not well received. One critic, Louis Biancoli from the New York World Telegram, said it was long, derivative, and teeming with weird sounds. Well, you can't please everyone, so let's head to the music, mes petits amis, and you can decide for yourself. The first movement or dance is marked non allegro. A rather curious marking, to say the least. Allegro is often defined as fast, but can also mean happy. And while this fabulous opening movement is many things, happy isn't one of them. We begin with a two-note, rather erratic heartbeat. If your heart is doing this, I would recommend you head to Sinai Emergency Room immediately. This is followed by a downward three-note idea. Yadadum. Pay attention to that three-note idea because it's going to go far. Next, some stentorian, rather severe block chords, then some portentous drums, followed by that three-note descending idea again. Finally, the three-note descending idea evolves into our first theme. Rachmaninoff gets quite a lot of mileage out of this theme. In this iteration, he transforms the piano, his beloved solo instrument, into an orchestral percussion instrument. The contrasting middle section also begins with the heartbeat, but in this case it goes somewhere quite different. It leads to some beautiful bird-like antiphonal wind writing. This, in turn, leads to one of the most poignant and beautiful melodies Rachmaninoff, or frankly anyone, has ever written. The composer sets it for alto saxophone, and to my ears, it is wholly Russian-sounding and replete with overwhelming innocence, nostalgia, and homesickness. As mentioned earlier, Rachmaninoff knew nothing about saxophones and sought the advice of the arranger and composer Robert Russell Bennett. Bennett remembered the following. When he was doing his symphonic dances, he wanted to use a saxophone tone in the first movement and got in touch with me to advise him as to which of the saxophone family to use and just how to include it in his score, his experience with saxophones being extremely limited. Some days later, we had luncheon together at his place in Huntington. When he met my wife and me at the railroad station, he was driving the car, and after about 100 yards, he stopped and turned to me and said, "I start on A sharp." I said, "That's right." He said, "Right," and drove on to his place. Here's the tune in the strings given the full Rachmaninoff Monty. Note once again the use of the piano. This beautiful reverie is soon ended, and we return to the tumultuous world of the earlier music. However, before the first dance ends, Rachmaninoff inserts a seemingly brand new melody. In fact, this lyrical tune is a quotation from Rachmaninoff's First Symphony of 1897. There's no way anyone other than Rachmaninoff or those present at the work's premiere could have known this. The piece was never published and was thought to have been lost. The second performance of the First Symphony took place in Moscow in 1945, 2 years after the composer's death. Rachmaninoff was completely crushed by the disastrous premiere and was haunted by it for much of his life. In its original incarnation of the symphony, the melody is quite dramatic. To complete his musical exorcism, Rachmaninoff has turned it into a lyrical gem. The second movement or dance is a waltz. It's not a Strauss waltz, but rather it's a Ravel or Prokofiev or Shostakovich waltz. There's something devious and maybe just a bit sinister about it. It even comes complete with Saint-Saëns' Danse Macabre solo violin. Not to mention the beautiful English horn and then oboe solo. And the delightfully decadent, lush string parts. The third and final dance begins with a slow introduction. Once again, we are in the world of the macabre. Before long, Rachmaninoff gives us a quote from a chant he used in his all-night vigil, sometimes called his Vespers. Blagosloven jesi Gospodi, blessed art thou, O Lord. After some transitional music, the tempo slows and Rachmaninoff quotes his favorite tune, the Dies Irae. The Dies Irae is a Gregorian chant used in the Requiem Mass. It translates to Day of Wrath, Day of Judgment. Since Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique of 1830, composers have been using it in concert music. We are all a bit unfamiliar with Gregorian chant these days. Allow me to quote the tune used in the Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique. Here is Rachmaninoff's setting. It's subtle, but the tune is there in the bass, going super slow. So Rachmaninoff has set up the Battle of the Chants, Gregorian versus Russian Orthodox. With about 2 minutes left in the piece, the Dies Irae returns with a vengeance. Then, at the end of the piece, on the last page of the manuscript, Rachmaninoff writes Alleluia in the score and quotes Blagosloven Jezi Gospodi, Blessed art thou, O Lord, one last time. Having finished the piece, Rachmaninoff wrote, I thank thee, Lord, at the end of the manuscript. So what is indeed great about Rachmaninoff's symphonic dances? 1. Rachmaninoff had an amazing facility for melody. Just the saxophone tune alone is spectacular, and there's so much more than that. 2. While Rachmaninoff is an amazing tunesmith, he is also an amazing moodsmith. In this piece, his final work, he goes way beyond his earlier efforts in terms of thematic development, invention, and orchestration. The composer once said, I try to make music speak directly and simply that which is in my heart at the time I am composing. If there is love there, or bitterness, or sadness, or religion, these moods become part of my music, and it becomes either beautiful, or bitter, or sad, or religious. 3. It is in many ways a summation of his career. By quoting from the earlier pieces, the composer bares his soul for us near the end of his life. There is so much genuine feeling here. Personally, I feel so much loss in the music. Rachmaninoff has lost Russia to the revolution and Europe to the Nazis. His conducting career never really blossomed, and his compositions became few and far between. Forced to play endless amounts of concerts, he was unable to devote the time to the other aspects of his prodigious gifts. His final concert took place in Knoxville, Tennessee, a month before his death. He was suffering greatly from melanoma, but felt obliged to play because the concert had already been postponed. This is the kind of man he was. A 12-foot bronze statue commemorates the events. Postscript. We all want to leave something on this planet after we are gone. Rachmaninoff left us this wonderful snapshot of his final years. The symphonic dances, his final work, and the only piece he composed in the United States, his adopted homeland. It's not sunny, but it is replete with truth. Allow me to end with a few words of New York Times critic Olin Downs, who said the following after the premiere. A melancholy, a fatalism, not frantic or exhibitionist, inhabits many of Rachmaninoff's pages. The dances have no ostensible connection with each other. They could easily reflect a series of moods presented in a certain loose sequence of nature and memories and reveries with some Dead Sea fruit in them, all unpretentious, melodic, sensuously colored, and admirably composed music. I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this has been a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for Sergei Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances.